Hey guys, I'm here to tell you about Space Rehearsal and Recording, a uniquely Austin experience. Preserving its musical heritage and inspiring future artists, Space is an affordable venue for rehearsal and recording situated on 9 acres, just a few short miles south of downtown Austin. With 31 spacious rooms, wide lit gallery corridors, and excellent parking, they've got the space, and equipment to help you with your creative endeavors. Their customers range from local and international musicians, acting troupes, yoga practitioners, and other performance artists. In fact, they also do photo shoots there, and you can rehearse there with your band. And you can also record there. It's a full functioning recording studio. Now, I am speaking from experience because I am in Skyrocket and we have a room there, and I am there once, sometimes twice a week rehearsing. And there's a great guy named Sonny there that has been in the biz for a long time, and I've known him, and it's great to see him all the time. And Will, who they own the place. They're fantastic people. They have a great place. It's nice and clean. The rooms are really nice. Some of them have windows. Yes, windows. Wouldn't you love to rehearse in a room with a window? Oh my God, it's great. They also support local artists. There's local art hanging on the wall. So you, as an artist, you can probably submit it there. So you can just go to spaceatx.com. And then, and for all your needs, it's a great website, tells you what's going on there. All the people that rehearse there, like the Black Angels, the Gourds, Alejandro Escobedo, and as I said, us, Skyrocket, we rehearse there. People have rooms there, and you can see a lot of cool people there. You know, maybe you can meet people and network and start a band, or maybe go down there and take your yoga classes, or, you know, teach yoga classes. Go on down there, check it out, spaceatx.com, talk to Sonny or Will. Their phone number is 512-448-9518, spaceatx.com. Now, let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time. How did I get here? And now here is your host, Tommy Maldi.
All right. Happy New Year. Happy 2014, everyone. I hope that you had a great, safe New Year's Eve and that you rang in the new year with loved ones, people that you care about. I did. I was with my friends in Skyrocket in Houston. We rang in the new year at Rockefeller Hall. A guy proposed to his wife and everything. It was crazy. And then I quit smoking. But before I get into that, let me tell you about who I've got on the show today. I have a great show for you today. First show of the year, I have Mike Flanagan. He's a B3 organ player here in Austin, Texas, who has had an extraordinary year playing the Crossroads Festival with Jimmy Vaughn, playing live on stage with ZZ Top at the Montreux Rock Festival, playing with Billy Gibbons, getting to play with Billy Gibbons on Live at Daryl's House, sorry, which airs on Palladia, I believe, this month or later this month or next month. Anyway, Mike is fantastic. He picked up the B3 kind of a little bit later than a lot of people, and he just really dove into it. He's got a band called Dupree that put out an album that's made it onto some top 10 people's list for albums of 2013. It has definitely made it onto mine. Since I knew he was going to come onto the show, I got the album, and I just totally love it. Anyway, I got to go see him play last week after we did this interview, and it was incredible. If you are in Austin, you should go tonight. He's playing, if you're listening to the day that it comes out, Friday, January 3rd, he's playing tonight at the Continental Club Gallery, and tomorrow, Saturday, January 4th, at the Continental Club Gallery, both places. Mike Flanagan Trio, it's a fantastic, fantastic experience. I highly recommend it to everyone. All right. We will get to my conversation with Mike in just a minute after I tell you, yes, I quit smoking. I am nuts. I played a show last night. I was supposed to do this intro yesterday. I just couldn't do it. I had a freak out, and I kind of made myself, zone myself into taking a nap before my show. And then when I got home last night, I was going to do this intro again. But I made myself go to sleep at like 9:30. Like, I made myself go to sleep because I couldn't take the cravings any longer. I was going nuts. Like, yesterday was like a white-knuckling experience playing the show. It's all I could think about. I talked about it a lot. Maybe I annoyed people with it. Anyway, I did have a good show at Strange Brew. I got to play with Matt the Electrician. Got to see him play a bit. That was great. It's always great to see him play. He's fantastic. He was on the show for episode 50. I think it's about time to get him back on the show. Matt the Electrician. I hate not smoking, man. I'm in my third day and I feel like I'm gonna freak out. Freak out. Let me tell you about New Year's Eve, though. Played with Skyrocket. Darren called me and he said, hey, there's a guy that wants to propose to his girlfriend, but it has to happen during this song that you sing. Bring the crowd down, walk around the crowd, give him the mic. He proposes to the lady. And the funny thing is, Darren kept on saying, assuming she says yes, you know, I'll kick back into the song and I would be like, wait a minute. And it would make me laugh. Just the thought of somebody going through such a grand gesture to propose to someone. And then right there, getting everyone's attention, everything stops. And then all of a sudden, the person goes, yeah, you know, I don't know if I want to marry you. That is fucking hilarious to me. And I'm sorry. I know. Just the idea of it, though, is hilarious. So I was like, well, man, if she doesn't say yes, I got to run out of the building for a song to get my shit back together before I come back. So anyway, she did say yes. It was a beautiful moment. It was caught on videotape. I think that it's on the Skyrocket Facebook page if you want to see it. It's a sweet moment. It is. It's a nice moment. So I'm glad I got to be part of that. We got to be part of that. And we got to ring in the new year together, which we have many, many years over the last decade and a half. My sweet friends, my good friends, my partners, Skyrocket. I love those guys. All right. So that was my New Year's. And other than that, man, my girlfriend gave me a beautiful Christmas present. She got me a painting by my friend Chris Taylor that you might have heard on the show. He's an artist. She had it commissioned. And I thought that was really sweet, very thoughtful gift. So I got that going. I've got a slow cooker and a slow cooker recipe book, which I'm going to take hold of. My hands are clammy from this. I hate this. I want to smoke. All right. Look, let's talk to Mike Flanagan because he's an amazing guy with an amazing story. And we have a really long conversation. And listen, Happy New Year to you and yours. Listen, I hope that 2014 is the best year yet for all of us. Seriously. And for Mike Flanagan as well. He had a great 2013. I'd like to see him top it in 2014. That would be a great thing for everyone. Mike Flanagan. All right, let's talk to him. Let's get down.
Possible, but it's not something I do all the time, you know.
So what's the setup? The trio is guitar, bass, and drums?
No, it's just guitar.
I mean guitar, bass, and keyboard. Sorry.
Guitar.
I mean guitar, drums,
organ,
and keyboard.
Yeah, drums.
Yeah.
So
what do you play, like foot, bass?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's fucking hard.
I know. It seemed impossible. Like when I first... I knew that's... I mean, I didn't start playing organ until way late, so... But I knew that's the way I wanted to play it, you know.
When you say, wait, okay, because that's something that I was getting to. I had,
That might be good for our conversation.
No, keep them off, because you seem comfortable. I'll just turn this up. Let me ask you this, because Todd Wolfson told me that you came into playing organ later.
Right.
Okay, but I thought he meant keyboards, and when I was listening to that this morning, and I've seen you play, I was like, if that guy... like, just started playing keyboards, like, 5 years ago or six years ago or something. I'm going to kill him.
No, it's not that, you know, quick. I started playing organ. I didn't play keyboards. I played guitar, you know.
Right.
And so then I was playing at Antone's. This is when Derek O'Brien went to prison for about a year, and so the Blue Monday band... wasn't really happening. So me and Johnny Moeller both played guitar. We filled in while Derek was gone. And but they had the Hammond B3 up there that they still have, you know.
Right.
Same one.
Yeah.
And I always loved the sound, you know. I always dug those records, you know, Jack McDuff and George Benson, whatever, those organ records. And but no one ever really played the B3 at that time. It would be up there. You'd see Mel Brown would play it maybe, or every once in a while.
What years was that? Well, it was also like, if you weren't like, you know, a guy, I mean, I remember trying to get, who was the guy that was stage manager? Steve?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hey, Steve Gutesky. Can't play it, man. I don't think they want you to play it. And I'm like, what is it up here if I want to play it?
Well, I definitely didn't know how to play it. And so how I started was I thought, well, I'm going to just go play the organ one night. But I didn't know how to play keyboards at all. Like, I didn't know anything about it. But Johnny was a great guitar player, and it was probably late. And I thought, well, go over there and fool with it. And so someone had told me, they said, well, find whatever the key you're in, and then if you count up 3 notes, that's a minor, and if you count up 4, that's a major.
Right.
Which actually is the best lesson you could get, you know. And so I start.
I love it if anyone that's a real big fan of yours is like, really, that's it.
That's what, that's that was it. His keyboard, you know, it's lesson? A great place to start. You know, if you don't know anything about a keyboard, and so I started just fooling around on it, and I would go up when other people were playing, like Derek would be playing, you know, Antone, the Antones people, whoever it was that night, and I would sneak up on the B3 and try and play it, because the only time I could try and play it was when someone was on stage, you know, and I didn't have one, and it's not like I was going down there during the day trying to figure it out, so it was pretty horrible, and Derek used to just, you know, yell at me, you know, like, I'd say, well, what key are you going to play in? Oh, we're going to play an A, and I was like, well, I'm not sure if I know how to do A, and he would say, you don't, you know, you don't, get off. He was really, hated it, and I don't doubt it, because I didn't know anything, but I did realize, like, right away, like, I had a natural kind of affinity for the B3, you know. I just liked playing it, and it's always sounded good. You didn't have to tune it. You didn't have to change the strings on it. Like,
yeah, but it's, I mean, if you want to play it and they don't have one there, that is like the world's biggest schlep.
Right. See, but I didn't think about that at the time.
Right.
Because I just thought, well, I'm just doing this for fun. I'm really a guitar player. Like, nobody's taking me seriously on this instrument, which was actually really freeing because, you know, when you are known as, okay, well, you are you play guitar, you play bass. Like, you're expected to be pretty good at it if you're on stage. But nobody expected me to be able to do anything. So anything I did was
awesome.
It seemed great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was so fun, you know. Yeah. I just loved it. I was like, oh, this is so much better, you know. And so I'd only been playing it a couple, 3 months at Antone's. And then Doyle Bramhall Sr. saw me playing it. And he hired me to play in his band, you know, and that was like, the band was Jim Milan on bass, Big Doyle, you know, on drums and singing, and Little Doyle was playing guitar. That was the band. I'd only been playing a few months, you know. I didn't know anything. And Big Doyle,
hey, dude, I don't even have one.
I mean, yeah, no, I didn't have one, right? I didn't have one. And so I had looked in the paper and for a keyboard. Like, I was like, I just need a keyboard so I can go home and try and figure out how to play one, right? Like, so then when I get to the club, I'll know more. But there happened to be that day in the paper, there was a Hammond organ. It was $700, you know. I was like, oh. And the keyboards were like $1,200. Yeah, like, here's exactly. A whole organ for $700. Little old lady, church lady, you know. And I called her and she said, well, there's, you know, I've had so many calls on this. Today, you know, that was the day it came out in the paper. She goes, whoever gets here first, you know, can have it. So it was way up north, and I drove up there as fast as I could. I got there, and she opened the door, and I saw it, and I was like, I'll take it. And I remember right when she opened the door, a guy drove up behind me and ran out, and he was like, I'll give you $1,000 for it. And she was like, no, I said, you know, whoever got here first, $700. So I got that organ, and I took it home. And that was a pivotal moment. I mean, you can't be an organ player if you don't have a organ, you know, because it had the pedals, it had everything, you know. It was Hammond organ, and
it had the drawbars.
Had the drawbars, had everything. It was a Hammond A100, which is the same thing as a B3. It's just the home unit of that. And then I would just sit. I just sat, and I would play Jack McDuff records or whatever. And try and figure out how they did the bass. You know, I wanted to do the bass and the foot bass and all that. And I eventually found a guy here in town, Bill Tanner, who was an old guy, you know. I asked Paul Ray, the DJ, I was like, who did this back in the day?
Yeah.
He said, well, Bill Tanner was the guy, you know, here in this, like, 70s. So I found him, and he said, yeah, come over. He had a B3 and two Leslies in his living room, you know. Didn't play out anymore. But he started doing the pedals, did the whole thing. And I just remember just looking at it going, how do you do that? How can you do that?
It's like dancing.
It seems impossible.
Yeah.
And he said, man, you just split your brain in two, you know. This is your bass, your left, you know, your left side. I thought, oh, that's crazy. I'll never do that. I'll never be able to do it. But I spent so much time. I would just sit there 12 hours a day, you know, whatever it was, you know, just.
You got to.
Play it.
Yeah.
Well, and I totally put the guitar down. That was over at that point because I thought, this is going to take so much time. I can't, like, I got to focus just on that. And what happened was, I immediately started getting gigs, you know.
That's what happened to me, too. I got that Rhodes behind that 54 that I could take places.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, my singer-songwriter friends were like, fuck, will you come do it?
Right.
You know? And I had gigs before I had
equipment.
The ability to play.
And the ability
to play, yeah.
Well.
Still cool.
Sometimes I think, you know, something about when you first start playing that, You're listening and you're not, sometimes the better you get, the worse you are. I don't know. Does that make sense? Like you feel
no,
like.
I think that once you know music and you approach a new instrument, especially one that's, I think with keyboards, it's different than like if you go from like guitar to like violin, you know what I mean? That's going to take a lot of fucking, or pedal steel or something.
Right.
Like
right.
It's all laid out so much easier than guitar that it's almost easier to just kind of, like you were saying, like. Feel your way through it.
Yeah.
Because it makes sense. As long as you know kind of the interval between the notes and you're starting in a key, you can jam, you know?
It's so
But
weird.
There's also a style to playing. There's a lot of percussive elements involved with playing a B3.
Right.
There's a lot, you know what I mean? There's like a lot of and like a lot grace of, notes and like.
Yeah. It's not like a piano. It's more, no. To me, it's like more like an electric guitar than a
Very
piano.
Much. And I bet that's why you related to it so well.
Exactly. And I can't play a piano. I still can't play a piano. Like, I never played piano. I just played the organ. It's all I had, and I never played anything else. So I don't sit and play piano. Like, people think it's the same thing because it has keys, but it's absolutely not.
No,
and
especially it speaks in a different way.
Yeah.
There's not way to keys. I mean, just in the first place, just the touch of it is so fucking different.
Yeah. Well, and since I started on organ, and there were organ players that did that, Groove Holmes and different people, and you're playing foot bass and left-hand bass, so you're not making chords with your left hand and doing all that stuff. You're doing everything with your right hand and your left hand.
Unless you're doubling bass with your left hand and your feet?
It's a combination of those two. And while Bill Davis and Jimmy Smith, these guys that invented how to do that, Bill Doggett, you have to do the left-hand bass, and actually getting to swing the left-hand bass is actually harder than the foot part. Like, but it's a combination of the two because they wanted it to sound like a stand-up bass. So it'd be like boom, 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 you know, and your pedals would come in and then it would go, you know, you would sound like you're shifting gear, you know, like, so you're doing the stuff with your pedals. Now, if you play a ballad, you would play like chords with your left hand. Or actually, Jimmy Smith played chords still with his right hand, and then he would play the melody with his left hand, do the foot bass. And so...
Then you got to split your brain three ways.
Right, and then your brain explodes at that point. But it's more of a flow. Like, it is like dancing. Like, if you had to think of every individual thing you were doing, it's like anybody in music. It all happens so fast and at the second, so you can't think of it. But it is like dancing, because it all becomes one...
Right.
Movement, you know, when you're doing all of it, you know?
Yeah.
And
it's like one of those things where people are like, how do you sing and play guitar at the same time? You're like, you know what? One day you can just do it. You just have to keep one day you just cross the line and you can actually do it.
Right.
And then you're on to the next, you know, hurdle.
Yeah. You know how you do it. You do it a zillion
Until
hours.
Until you can do it. Yeah.
Until you do it. Yeah. And
you Gladwell that motherfucker. You're familiar with Malcolm Gladwell, and said, like, no one can really do anything proficiently until they do it for 10,000 hours.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
Because when you think back at how many hours you've put into something. It gets, when you get to be about the 10,000 mark, that's probably when you really hit on something.
Well, that's the weird thing that gets me, because like you and another friend of mine, Rick, you know Ricky Ray Jackson?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like that guy, like I remember I was making a record 6 years ago or something with Jonas Wilson, and he said, oh, we should get Ricky to come in here and play pedal steel. And I was like, all right, look, man, you know, that's like, that's not an instrument. He's like, oh, Ricky started playing pedal steel. We should get him to come in and play on it. And I was like, oh, Jesus, that could take all night. You know, some guy that just started playing pedal steel, that sounds like,
right,
it's terrible. That's like, I just got this guy that just started playing violin or something. You're like, no.
Not a,
but that guy,
he's amazing.
He threw himself into it, like for a year, like you did, playing like 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
That's always the thing that fascinates me, because like, to me, like being a kid is when you have that time to do that. And it's always weird to me when someone learns something as an adult and gets that good at something.
Right, because you don't have the time to
yeah,
put, you don't,
I mean,
have
luckily
the hours.
We have the kind of jobs that we do have the hours.
Well, but what happened to me on that, right when I first started playing the B3, right at that time, well, that's when my son was born. So I was just sitting at home all day taking care of him.
Yeah.
So I would just set him up next to the B3 and play all day long, and, you know, just do whatever I had to do with him. And
right.
But, you know, you're at home. So that's how that started, really.
Yeah.
So I had a kid. I was at home, you know. And
wow.
So I had the hours to devote to it. And I would still, like, you know, I was married at the time, and my, you know, once my wife got home, you know, then I would practice for 6 hours. You know, there was no, it was probably a miserable marriage for her, because it was, you know, what I'm saying. It was like,
yeah,
I was just married to try and figure out how to play the B3.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, which just seems like an insane thing to do anyway. But there was some...
Not, you know what, not to hear you and not to see what's happened.
Well,
you know what I mean? It's really like, it opened like a whole new avenue of, didn't it?
Yeah.
Did it not?
Oh, no.
I mean,
it,
like.
It did, you know.
Like, to use a football analogy, it's like someone made a hole for you, you just ran right through. Like, hey, here's a B3. Whoop.
Right.
It, but Madison Square Garden. You know what I mean?
No, that's exactly right.
Like,
there was definitely some moments, yeah, this year where you really do go, how did I get here?
Yeah.
I'm not really sure, but I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, and you look back and then you see,
yeah,
well, this
steps.
Is how you got here. But when you're there, and you know how it is, when you're there, and it only happens a few times when you're going, wow.
Yeah.
How did I get here?
I must have done all the things right that you're supposed to do, and I didn't even think.
Yeah.
But the weirdest thing is, it wasn't like there. You're always kind of just using the force to get through, so you never know the actual right way to do it. But you can look back and go like, wow, I did everything right.
Right. And a lot of it seemed wrong at the time.
Sure. Yeah,
what
am I doing spending 12 hours a day playing this weird organ in my house when I should be out, you know, playing guitar?
Yeah, especially because I had a pretty decent career as a guitar player.
Yeah.
And people were going, well, you're a good guitar player. What are you doing?
Right.
You know, because now you've thrown your little career away, basically. You know,
you kind of took yourself out of the callings, you know, hey,
yeah,
come on out and play
yeah,
again.
You know, it was, and I had done, you know, some good stuff on guitar, but I never had the, I mean, and I love guitar even today. I love guitar players. And part of my reason for playing organ, I think in the back of my mind at that time was, you know, I love great guitar players so much. I want to play with great guitar players. I don't want to be the great guitar player. I want to go play with the great guitar players.
Right.
You know, I want to play with those guys. I don't even care what I'm playing.
Yeah.
You know, I play bass if I could, you know, whatever,
right.
Whatever. Like, I just love great guitar players. And
right.
And luckily, I play with so many great guitar players. And I just love hearing them. I love guitar, you know.
Well, in guitar, I'd always heard you play more roots and blues, but could you speak in that jazz language that you can?
Oh, when
on
I
the
played
organ?
Guitar? No. Because
you did learn a different language.
That came
language.
Later. Yeah, that came later. That came with the organ, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and there's some real...
And
I mean, you're really playing jazz. You're not like some dude.
Well, it was, and how that really came about, you know, I wanted, when I played the organ, because there's a lot of different ways you could play it. You could play it like, you know, Al Cooper. You could play it like Booker T. There's a lot of different styles, you know, and in music, you know, of ways to play it. And each style is just pretty specific. You know, you have to know that
yeah.
style.
Yeah.
You know, it's not easy people that could go and back up a singer-songwriter on an album, you know, those people know that style. There's a style to that.
Right. That Benmont style.
Yeah. That's not something, that's not a Jack McDuff style.
Right.
You know, just because you play organ, people think, oh, well, you play organ. You play, it's all the same.
Yeah.
It's kind of, that's, and which is crazy because no one thinks of guitar players that way.
Right.
No one goes, oh, well, you play guitar. Well, obviously you can play every situation.
right.
So I chose early on, I was like, well, I want to play this style, which is, you know, that 60s soul jazz style that, you know, Jimmy Smith and Big John Patton and Jack McDuff and Jimmy McGriff, that's what I wanted to learn, you know, and that's what I set out to learn. And really the big step in that direction, because I didn't know jazz, I didn't know any of that, was when I went, we moved to Boston for about a year, and I went and found Big John Patton, who was a organ player on Blue Note, you know, in the 60s, made a lot of records. Worked with Lou Donaldson and made a lot of records with Grant Green and great, my favorite records. He was my favorite guy, Big John Patton. And I found him in New York, you know. I would go down. I saw he was playing a gig, and so I went and saw him. And I'm really shy about, you know, asking guys, or, you know, even talking to these people. And so, but I did, you know, I asked him, and he was very intimidating, you know. He was dark. He was like Miles Davis dark, and he could look at you, and it was just like, but he was a very nice guy, but he was an intimidating character if you just looked at him, you know.
Yeah.
And he was like, no, yeah, come over to the house, you know. And I went over to his house the next day, and he had, you know, a B3, and he lived in Montclair, New Jersey with his wife, Thelma. They had an apartment. And he had his B3, and it was the same one he had had. He bought it in 1963 at Macy's with Grant Green. They walked in and bought it at Macy's in New York. He used to sell Hammond organs. Still in the same one. So he had it in his little hallway in his apartment, you know. And he showed me how to play the organ right, like in the jazz way, like with the pedals, with the left hand, how to make the chords, how changes work, you know, how to figure out a song, what to do. And if not for him, I wouldn't
be playing. Did you invite him out when you were there?
What's that?
Did you invite him out when you were there last week?
No, you know, sadly, he passed away.
Oh, that's sad.
Just a couple years after I met him.
That's a drag.
But it was enough, and I still have hours and hours of taped phone conversations of him. He would be playing his house out, and he would be showing me stuff over the phone. And I still go back and listen to that because there was a lot of things. I mean, he was a master.
That's awesome.
He was a master. He's one of the 10 legendary jazz organ players, you know. And there was a lot of stuff at the time. I just didn't have the ability to understand. I was too new at it. I'd only been playing a couple of years or something. And so I'll go back now and I'll still learn stuff. And so that without him, there's no way I would be doing what I'm doing now. Not without John Patton. I know that, absolutely certain. Because Bill Tanner here helped me out. But John Patton was encouraging, and he was like, man, you can play. When he told me I could play, nobody else thought I could play. I didn't think I could play. I wanted to play. Nobody else thought I could play, but John Patton thought I could play. And when John Patton thought I could play, I didn't care about anybody else, what anybody else thought, you know. And even to this day, you know, not everybody's going to like what you do or think you could play. And it doesn't matter, you know, if you love what you're doing. But I always
even
know,
if people didn't like what you did, you can still play. I mean,
yeah, you could.
There's people that I can see and I go, I don't like that guy, what he's doing, but he can play.
You know? Exactly. Because it's all style at a certain point, or, you know, ultimately you're trying to express something, and all that's, you know, subjective. So, but once John Patton said that, and then that gave me a lot of confidence. And so when I came back to Austin, I was only in the Northeast a real short time. So when I came back to town, of course, when I came back to town, there was no organ anything scene.
No.
Zero. I mean, there was nobody playing like that. Red Young had not moved to town. He moved to town right after that. But there was no clubs to play at. I mean, I played at the Poodle. I think I remember the first time I played the organ out, like once I got an organ and I went out to do it as a trio. I played at the Poodle Dog Lounge. It was my very first time. I hauled it up there. You know, nobody knew what it was. I could probably barely play. And I remember people, you know, asking. I remember one guy asked if we could play ZZ Top. And I'm thinking, how would we play ZZ Top? You know, ironically enough. Right? I'm like, this is an organ trio. But nobody knew what that was. And even, and if it wasn't for the gallery's what made everything happen. Because Steve Wertheimer, I had played downstairs happy hours. He was always supportive of kind of what I was trying to do. But one day when, during South by Southwest, I guess it's been 6 or 7 years ago, he said, oh, let's, you know, we had this idea. We'll take the organ up to this storage room that he had. You know, that wasn't a club, the gallery. It was a storage room that time.
Yeah.
And he got it because he didn't want to pay the electricity bill on that, whatever was up there. And so he bought him out or whatever. And so we took the organ up there and he sold beer. And of course, you know, it was all illegal at the time. They shut it down eventually. Right, right. So we just left the organ up there. And I would go up there and play Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. Nobody else played up there because there was no lights. Like, I finally went down to Home Depot and bought, like, a light, like, so people could see the band. But we would make maybe $20 a piece or something. Nobody even knew it was a club. It really wasn't. But the organ was there, you know, and we left it there. And then eventually, once he got his license and all that, then people started coming up. Well, once people started coming up, then it was like, and of course now it's like you can't even get a slot up there. It's every night. There's happy hour bands. There's, but also what happens became, because it had a B3 there, you know, Red Young plays there on Tuesday with Ephraim, you know, James Polk plays there Monday with Elias Hasslinger. You know, the Greyhounds play there on Wednesday.
Right.
You know, it almost became a scene. There was no scene. You know, there was nobody doing it. There was nobody playing it. And Red Young came to town, but there was still, you know, you might see him at the Elephant Room or some little club. You know, he'd be hauling that B3 around, and I was hauling a B3 around to wherever you could find a gig. But the gallery cemented that thing, and it educated people. They'd come up and go, well, what kind of piano is that? What are you doing? And I still get that.
Why is that? I mean, since I've known instruments, I knew what that was.
I know, but you'd be surprised how many people are like, even last night, I had a friend of mine that I've known for many, many years from Dallas. He came up with his son. He's known me. I don't know if he's ever seen me play, but he came up, and at the end of the night, he goes, who was playing bass all night? Where was the bass coming from? And I was like, well, that was the pedals and left-handed stuff. Wow.
Just so weird. It just seems like if you saw a Doors documentary, you'd know that.
You would know that, but
that's so weird.
But now, you know, people in Austin know, they're very familiar with it because of the gallery. You know, a lot of people go to the gallery and they might see Red Young, they might see the Greyhounds, they might see James Polk. You know, you see people doing that. You know,
well, there's a guy. I mean, Mac schleps his thing down to Lounge.
Yeah, and I'm leaving Mac out. Yeah. You know, but that, I think of him. You know, that's these guys are warriors. I mean, a guy like Mac, you know, one of the greatest B3 players, you know, ever. And
he's a different style than you.
It's a different style. Yeah. I can't play that style. If you want me to play, that is an art. You know, these things are different. These styles are different art forms of playing organ.
Well, he's also like an architect of.
Yeah.
Certain style of,
well, exactly.
You know,
like how they had to invent that. Yeah. Well, you know, there was no music like that at the time. How do you play organ on this? Well, we'll invent it. You know, what about this? And it sounded great. But that, I don't pretend to know how to play like that because I've spent all my other time trying to do other style of music and stuff. I mean, I can kind of do it a little bit, but it's like there's an art to that. There's a super art to what Mac is doing, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's why he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I mean, not that it's for a different reason than Donna Summer is. Nothing against Donna Summer, but it is for a different reason.
Exactly. No, that's true, you know. So I have so much respect for Mac, and I've had, you know, conversations with him, and he's come up, and we've just fooled around on the B3, and he's told me so many great stories about when Booker T came to Europe and seeing him and just different stuff, you know, that, and I've had some, you know, we've all had those many moments like that, that you just thought, well, I would never thought I would even meet this guy.
Oh yeah.
You know, now we're, you know, sitting down and playing.
Yeah. You know, what's so weird is if there was one thing like that, I used to have they did these concerts for MS like in the early 80s.
Uh huh.
And it was all those guys, and they were for Ronnie Lane.
Right.
Like, I guess Ronnie Lane Trust, but it was like Jimmy Page and Mac and all of those guys. And I had a circus magazine that had like an article about it, but I cut out all the pictures, and I had those pictures on my wall when I was like 14.
Yeah.
And then I moved here in 91 and started working at, I was working at Whole Foods. I was a cashier, and Ronnie would come through my line. It was so fucking surreal. It was like, whoa, that's the guy from the pictures on my wall when I was like 14 years old. That is right. So weird. Yeah.
We idolize these people, and for good reason, shit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
pioneers, I mean, in our
what's
trade.
That?
They're pioneers of our trade.
No, that's true. And just as at one point, I think I realized too, like, I think being a musician is maybe the most important job in the whole world.
Oh, yeah.
Even though you don't get paid like it is, and people don't maybe treat you like it or think of it. But, and what made me, I think the first time I thought that was after, like, when Katrina hit and all that happened down in New Orleans. And I remember the first thing everyone was saying was, like, we want to get the musicians back. I didn't even cared about.
Yeah.
I wasn't hearing, like, well, we need to start building all this stuff and clearing
the debris. We need to get the musicians
back. Yeah, they were,
like,
day one, yeah. Day two of that was, like, well, we got to get the musicians back.
Yeah.
And that somehow that really struck a chord in me, because I thought, you know, music is so important.
Oh, yeah, and it's everywhere.
And it's everywhere, and if you didn't have it, you know.
Even deaf people listen to music. I mean, honestly, deaf people get off on music.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I had a friend of mine last night who's deaf, who's up at the gig, and he sits right up front and feels the bass pedals, and he could tell he feels it, and he's just smiling.
Yeah.
It's amazingly important, you know,
yeah.
And I think maybe part of that was when I realized it was my job, not just to be able to go in a club and play songs or whatever, was like to try and be, you know, an artist at some point.
Yeah.
Which I always like steered away from that word, but then I realized like that was your job, was like to be that. You know?
Yeah. To make things where there once was nothing.
Right.
You know?
Right.
To create something where once was nothing.
Yeah, which really is not something you think of. At least I didn't. I mean, I look back at it when I was a kid. Those things were always there. But when I started playing music, I never thought, well, this is what the intention of all this is for, you know, like to communicate with people. And because you just like, I want to play this cool lick.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with people or communicating or emotions
right.
or anything. That you figured that out later, you know. And, you know, I don't know where I was going with that.
No, that's all right. so you played for, how many years have you been playing up in the gallery since it opened?
Since it opened, I want to say that's six-ish years. And, so that's really when I started playing, because I was playing 4 days a week. I couldn't even find enough drummers. And the other important thing was when Frosty came to me and said, I will be your drummer every Friday and Saturday. Because he grew up playing organ music. Obviously, he played with Lee Michaels, and he's played with so many great people.
And he played with Sly Stone, too.
Played with Sly Stone. He played with Parliament Funkadelic. He played with Ike and Tina. He's played, you know, he played drums on that song, Car Wash. I mean, he's you know.
That's him on Car Wash?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm so intimidated by that dude. I can't even ask him to be on
Frosty.
This show.
Well, you know, he can be intimidating.
He looks intimidating. I don't think I think I'm just scared of approaching.
Yeah, he's not, you know, when you talk to him, he's very sweet, very nice guy. He's not like that. But I could see where you would think that because people like that, they are not going to sugarcoat anything for you or play, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
They're going to say like it, however they think.
Sure.
And, so you just never know. I mean, you know, who knows? It's always frightening when you talk to people like that.
So he came to you and asked you?
Well, no, I think maybe we had played a couple times. I was afraid to ask him to play, but I think, I was running out of drummers. I had 4 nights a week up there, and the pay was $20. Well, how many drummers you going to get? And, you know, that's a tough room to play because it's like a racquetball court. As good as it sounds, you put a set of drums in there, and it can sound like a racquetball court, you know, with a bomb going off.
Yeah.
So Frosty came to me and said, I'll play if you want me to. I'll play every weekend with you. Well, that changed everything, because then all of a sudden I had a great drummer. And if you're playing B3 like that in a trio, the one thing you've got to have is a great drummer.
Yeah.
If you don't have a great drummer, everything depends on drums.
I must say a lot. I'd say a lot for your feel on the bass too, because a guy like that doesn't want to sit up there with some stiff ass.
Well, and that was
a bass player that can't swing it.
And you know, Frosty had a lot of patience because I, you know, and I'm still learning today. You know, I was, and back then, you know, I was still learning. But he knew what I was trying to do, and he liked playing that style of music, and he just came through. And had it not been for Frosty, I don't know if I'd be. There's so many of these people. Like, if it weren't for Frosty, I don't think I'd be here. If it weren't for John Patton, I don't think I'd be here. If it weren't for a million people.
I think that's one of those things that's the culture of Austin that makes it special and unique, is that we all do, I mean, for the most part, and I've done a lot of these shows too where I talk to people, everybody pays reverence to the guys that came before, and those guys don't resent you. They want to help you get to their thing. You know what I mean?
Right.
All the guys that are older than me have always been fucking super cool to me.
Yeah, I've never seen it any other way. In this town. Like, they, because they're like, "Oh, you're part of this little tribe we got."
Yeah.
You know, they're like, "Oh yeah, you're one of us."
Yeah. And they're guys even like Van Wilkes, like they're guys that still, like, to this day. I mean, he's very humble about his thing, and you know what I mean? Yeah. And he's kind of like, he doesn't see himself as the greatest thing that ever happened, but still, to me, he's like a guy that there's a certain level of respect that I should pay to him, because he paved this road and inspired me in certain ways growing up. You know what I mean?
Oh, well, absolutely. Like, you know, and you look, I mean, I, one of the really big moments when I look back at it, to me, you know, speaking of people like this, was you know, when I was a kid, there was the Rolling Stones played the Cotton Bowl, you know. And my oldest sister was supposed to go with her boyfriend, but she had to work. So he ended up taking me. And the gig was, I think it was 1980. It was like the Rolling Stones with ZZ Top and the Fabulous Thunderbirds. That was the thing. Well, I was really in.
That is awesome.
Right?
That is awesome.
So I look back at this, right? And I remember turning the corner and seeing, I knew ZZ Top. We had their albums. Me and my brother loved ZZ Top. I was probably there more for ZZ Top than the Stones at the time. Like, I just loved ZZ Top. I had never heard of the T-Birds, but I remember turning the corner to when you could view the field, and seeing Jimmy Vaughn and the T-Birds, and I thought, that's cool. What is that? You right?
Yeah.
And then I remember I had a seat way in the back. You know, there was a column in front of me. I had to, like, look around. But that was a big thing for me. I look back at it because I ended up playing with Jimmy. I ended up playing with Billy, right? And I was a kid.
You ended up playing with ZZ.
Yeah.
I mean, geez, that's not a lot of dudes outside of the three of those guys that have played with ZZ Top.
I know. That was one of those moments you go, how did I get here? That was definitely one of those. Like, when I was watching ZZ Top that night that I played with them, and I was watching from the side of the stage, and they're doing like all great songs, right?
Yeah,
that I love. Yeah. That I, you know, and I've probably been to 7 or 8 ZZ Top concerts over. You know, I went to the, you know, every, you know, the El Loco. You know, I saw them at the Winter Garden.
You used to go to the Texas Jam and stuff.
I went to the Texas Jam. Yeah. I forget what years, but I saw, you know, Christopher Cross, the Eagles, Cheap Trick. This was one bill. You know, I love the Texas Jam. I went to 2 of them, I think. And, but yeah, I thought, at some point, these guys are going to call me up, and it is going to be weird because I'm watching ZZ Top, and then they're going to say, "Hey, come play," right? Like in the middle of the ZZ Top show. And nobody plays with it, right? ZZ Top is ZZ Top. It's you know, Frank and Dusty, right? And Billy. And so it was that was a big moment because you cannot help but go back in your mind to when you were a kid at the Cotton Bowl and watching that band. That was the first concert I had ever seen. Like, that was the first show I ever saw guys on stage playing. Right? And
that is unfucking believable.
It's so weird. And I never thought I would be a musician. Like, I never started off. Like, I always played. And I worked at a pawn shop in high school. And everybody in the pawn shop played guitar, right?
Yeah.
And they were all great. These guys are going to be musicians. They're musicians. They played in bands and stuff. I never played in a band. I'm the worst guy in this place. I never thought about being a musician. I thought there was two kinds of musicians, like Michael Jackson, right?
And super famous.
Super famous.
Or the guy in the Holiday Inn bar.
Yeah, or somebody that you did, like some guy did it for fun or something. I didn't know that there was another strata of being a musician. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And so...
That's interesting because I grew up with that knowledge, and I always say like it was always very like I knew the guy that played guitar, in a other band,
right?
You know what I mean? That was what he did for a living. He would go out and tour with this guy,
yeah.
See, I'd come back and tour with that lady.
I never knew that,
yeah.
But I always loved music, you know. Like, but and what was so odd too was I grew up in a house. My older sisters played piano. My oldest sister played church. I remember this church organ. She was the church organist. She had a white B3 and a white Leslie. I remember I was a little kid. I was under 8. And she would play. And I always thought that was cool.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, that's cool. We had a piano at our house. I never touched it. Like, I didn't think that was cool for some reason. But I thought the organ was cool.
Yeah.
At church. And so, I forget what I was talking about. But anyway, so...
Well, you were talking about how you didn't know, you thought there was two kinds of guys, hobbyists and then like Michael Jackson.
Right. And so that's what I thought. And then, I played guitar and then I got really my first serious, when I got serious about music, like I really wanted to find out, was banjo. I really got into banjo. And so I built a banjo from this kit, you know, and there was a guy that I would go... He taught guitar, and I would go mow his lawn, and he would kind of teach me some stuff. But he would go to all these bluegrass festivals and sell, like, set up a little tent and sell, like, capos and pigs or whatever. And so I would go with him, and then I would enter all these banjo competitions, right, at the bluegrass festival. And I would win these competitions. Like, nobody knows. I don't even think my family still knows that. Like, I never told anybody. Like,
you didn't come back with, like, a ribbon? Like, hey, no, I won the banjo festival.
No, I don't even remember I don't even remember the particulars of it. And I don't
it was
remember.
Like a shameful instrument to be playing.
It was, I thought, well, for sure. Of course, now, you know, it seems like every band has a banjo. But at the time, I thought, but I was so into it. But I don't think I really told anybody that much that I was at these festivals and stuff. I don't think my family, if I told them today, they would be like, really? But... I just did that for fun, and then I didn't get on a stage to play until I was 25, you know? And that was because, well, I'll take that back. Get on a stage to play a gig. I had met Johnny Moeller. I worked at a pawn shop, Johnny and Jay Moeller, who play in the Fabulous Thunderbirds now.
Yeah.
You know those guys.
Yeah.
I met them because Johnny came in. I sold him his first guitar, you know, at the pawn shop. That's how I met Johnny.
Wow.
You know? And so we would go around to Dallas to these blues jams and stuff. Anson Funderburg and Sam Myers was a band that was really... That was some other people that were like, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be playing. Because I was like, oh, I want to do that, you know?
Yeah.
And so anyway, again, I forget what I was talking about.
Let me ask you this.
Oh, wait. Okay, getting on a stage. That's what
I was saying. Okay, getting on stage for the first time.
Right, so I had played these jams. Me and Johnny would go around. Well, Johnny had a gig with a band. You know, he was a kid, but he was making pretty good money in Dallas playing in a group. And he had to go to California to play in a group. And so he said, do you want to take my place in this group, you know? Well, I had a job, you know. I thought, well, yeah, I'll go play on the weekends on this thing. And... I remember the first gig, it was a Holiday Inn on I-35 in Dallas. It's still there, it's something else now, but it was in Lancaster. And I remember having to play the whole gig and thinking how hard it was to play, like, three sets, like, all night long. Like, it's one thing to play two or three songs at a jam. It's another thing to have to play three sets. And I remember my hands felt like they were going to fall off. But that was how I started playing. And I got in that band. That's when I started playing. Well, of course, and at that time, there was a lot of, you could make good money in Dallas playing, you know.
Were you, but, like, at those places? Because I just remember the I remember hanging out at like a Holiday Inn bar for some reason with somebody.
Yeah, it was like the band. Dallas had like a million places to play, and they were all horrible, right?
Like just Chelsea Street Pub kind of thing.
Yes, yeah, I mean they were all like. And I went back to Dallas like this year, and a friend of mine had a gig, and I went to it, and it just reminded me of every gig we had ever had. It was a gig. No one was paying attention to the band, and there was like eight TVs behind them.
All showing different sports. Yes. Yeah, I hate fucking TVs at gigs.
I went back to my hotel, and there was a little bar. I wanted to get something to eat, and I asked the doorman. He said, well, there's a place, a bar around the corner, still serves, you know, hamburgers, stuff, whatever. So I went over there, and they had an organ trio over there. It was Eric Scorcia, which, I mean, I've heard about, but I've never met him, you know. They were playing, but it was like, oh, this is great, man, I love this. But it was the same sort of thing. Typical Dallas, yeah. Everybody in an uproar, you think they're clapping for you, and it's just, you know, touchdown.
Someone scored, yeah.
And but you could, you know, but we made livings up there. You know, like you could make a living. Yeah. You know, that was the thing. Like you could make a living in Dallas playing music, and you could come to Austin. You couldn't make a living, but you could. But it was cooler. You know, there was real music going on.
Yeah, yeah.
That was always the thing, you know.
Yeah.
And but yeah, so once I started playing. And then I started playing, and then I quit my job, and I thought, well, I'll just do this, you know. This seems so much more fun, because I was having to get up at 7 in the morning, and I remember thinking, oh, I don't think I can do this for how long you would have to do it, you know.
Yeah.
Your whole life. Like, there's no breaks. Like, you have to get up every day, and then you're working all day, and then... And then I thought, oh, I just can't do that. I just remember thinking, I can't do that.
So many people go do that every single day, but so many of us have. I mean, especially also after you do it for a long time, do you ever wonder now, Mike, do you ever go like, if I was going to do something else?
Oh, yeah.
What would I be able to do?
Oh, well, like, I wouldn't be able to do anything.
I don't have any skills.
No, I have no skills. I haven't had a job since that was my last job, you know. That was forever ago, like. I would have no skills. I would have no skills. I'm not marketable. There's nothing. And I did realize, too, because early on, I remember looking at Johnny and those guys, and I thought, man, these guys are going to make it in music because they've got nowhere else to go. They've got to make it.
Yeah.
They can't fall back. And I thought, early on, I thought, well, see, that's my problem is I can fall back. Like, I've got something else I could do, you know. And,
it's a lot different when there's...
And those guys did continue on because they had to. And then I always worried about that. Like, well, I'm not one of those guys. Like, I could... Of course, now I am one of those guys. Yeah. So much time has passed. Like, yeah, now I'm one of those guys. Which is, I think, a good thing because, hey, man, sink or swim. You have to do it. Like,
but what's interesting also is you did create another avenue, not only for your creativity, but also you diversified your talents and almost increased your business. You broadened your business a little bit.
Right. Yeah.
That's genius.
I mean, it's...
I mean, if there was a business guy that was like, hey, you know how like business guys sometimes, like an uncle or whatever, at a party, so how much you making? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Right.
Those kind of guys, like that kind of guy would be proud of you. He'd be like, hey, you're not just digging yourself in a hole.
And I thought, you know, you look around and you go, God, there's so many great guitar players in this town. It was like, they didn't need me in here, right? And... So that was part of it too. I thought, well, you know, what am I going to do? You know, there's so much competition and these guys are all great and I'll never be as good as Johnny standing right next to me. You know, like he came out great. I saw him when he was a kid, you know, and he played just like Otis Rush. And I was like, well, who in the hell is that guy? Like, you know?
Yeah.
So
let me ask you this: what from being from playing in the gallery? That's where Jimmy saw you. That's where Gibbons saw you,
right?
And what happened? Jimmy said, "Hey, come play this thing," because you played at the Crossroads Festival with him,
right?
Did you? Who all did you jam with there?
There was Clapton? I just played with Jimmy on that.
But there wasn't a Clapton on stage?
There wasn't. No, Clapton never came out on ours. But Doyle? Well, I'll tell you what happened was Jimmy had his birthday party out in Fredericksburg. It was his 60th birthday party. This is kind of when everything started happening. Like, I played with Jimmy a little bit. He would come up to the gallery, and I would always try and get him to sit in, and he said no. He would always say no, and then one day he said, well, can you come over to my house? I want to kind of know what to do. Maybe we can work up a couple songs. That's how it started.
Yeah.
And so I was so afraid, right? Like, I remember going at this when he lived in town, and I thought, oh, my God, I got to go over to Jimmy's today. Right, he had a B3 in his house, and we were just going to sit and play.
All these dudes, you know that have B3s in their house.
I know that was actually super lucky, right? And Jimmy loves, you know, he had Bill Willis, great, you know, such a great organ player, but anyway, he's like, yeah, come over to the house, and I was so afraid because Jimmy's an intimidating character. Not when you get to know him, he's the sweetest guy there is. You know?
But I mean, he's a guy that we've grown up seeing him play. You saw him with the Rolling Stones on a giant stage in a football stadium.
Right, right.
Yeah, what you mean.
Right, when you were coming up in Dallas, when we were coming up in Dallas trying to play guitar, that was the guy you were trying to be, right? Like, everyone was. It wasn't a secret. And so, I went over his house, and so that, you know, snowballed, and then Jimmy started playing, you know, he'd come play gigs, and now he plays all the time. We've been doing that for several years, and also that's how Gibbons stumbled in there. I can't remember if Jimmy was playing with me the first time Gibbons came up, and that's why he came up, but he came up, and see, Gibbons' dad had one of the first B3s. His dad was a great orchestrator and musician, band leader, and keyboard player, piano player, and he also was a Hammond organ player. And so Gibbons really loved, you know, he loved the Hammond, you know. So he was always all about it. He would sit in, and so...
Sitting in on guitar?
Sit in on guitar, yeah. Gibbons?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was that like the first time when he's like, hey, did he say, hey, can I play? Or did you say, hey, do you want to play? Or was there a third party?
No, like an
Andy Langer, like, hey, maybe you can get Gibbons up there.
I can't remember exactly how that went down, but...
I know I'd answer yes, but I don't know if I'd start, like, crying or, like, berating myself.
It's so funny, like, I'm not...
He's so nice, too.
Oh, he's so nice. Like, all those guys are so nice, man. And he's nice to just everyone in the world.
Yeah.
He'll bump into someone on the street, and he'll start pulling stuff out of his pockets to give to them.
He's
always giving people stuff. Always presents, little things, you know, whatever it is. Like, that guy thinks more about other people than I think anybody I've maybe ever met, which is ironic.
That is the coolest thing ever to hear.
And because as a musician, you know, your job is kind of be self-absorbed in a way. Like, that's
what I've been telling people for years.
Like, right? Yeah, like, it's just like, you have to think about, I don't know, it's just a kind of that kind of role, and it can...
Well, especially somebody that stratospherically famous, because things change for people.
Yes.
You know, there is a Jimmy Bond kind of famous, but there's a Billy Gibbons. Billy Gibbons is a guy that, like, if you drew a picture, and I've said this before on here, if you drew a picture of sunglasses and then a triangle below, and you handed and you showed it to somebody, they would say ZZ Top.
Yeah.
You just draw not even a face.
Right.
They were such a, they still are, but they went through that sort of like, stratosphere, like,
yes,
you know,
I mean,
the most played band on the radio, the most videos on MTV, you know,
that level of fame is different when you walk down the street with Gibbons, and it's almost like walking out. He's so lovable by a kid,
right,
or someone who's 90 years old. I mean, it's like being with Santa Claus. Like, everyone loves him.
It's like being with Willie Nelson. Like, that's another stratospherically famous person.
Yes.
You know,
yeah, and it's just, you're around them, and it's such a good positive energy.
You know, the thing is, too, is he just hangs out. Like, he goes to the guest, leans back against the thing, and then people come, hey, Billy, and he's like, oh, hey, how you doing?
Oh, yeah. He'll draw people pictures. You know, he always carries a pad with him, you know, sign autographs, draw a little picture of himself. Just all the time. He's always prepared for that. He knows. Here's the other thing that I really observed, like, Jimmy, and I really observed Billy, how they handle life and being a musician that
because they don't fame. They don't have to just worry about music or creating stuff. They also have to deal with almost deflecting energy. Yes.
And
where to put their energy, because it's a little more precious because it's being yanked out all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen them handle, like, you know, I've seen Jimmy, you know, the most people just, you know, in the gallery, there's no stage, there's no
nothing.
Velvet rope.
If you're him.
You're there.
Yeah.
If you're Jimmy or you're Billy, whatever, you're there. And you're there with everybody else, which is the great thing about it. But... Yeah. Sometimes you might get somebody that had too much to drink, and then they're asking. I mean, I've seen people ask Jimmy inappropriate stuff.
I can only imagine. I can only imagine.
He's always great about it.
Yeah.
He's always so... Somehow he handles everything so great. Right. He's like a king, you know?
Right.
And Gibbons is the same way. He just handles... He knows, like you said, how to deflect energy or move. It's just amazing to watch.
Because there's a lot of energy coming at you.
Yeah.
And being pulled out of you. So it's at a greater thing than any of us understand even.
Yeah, and it's good to watch because we all, if you know, you play and you're playing and you'll have to deal with things.
I hate drunk people that are identifying with me.
And you know, and what you learn, like, you just learn a lot watching those guys because you're there for those people. And sometimes people are super drunk and their intentions are good, but you have to deal with it. And you want them to feel... When those people leave, I still want those people to feel good because they came out and they were enjoying
it,
right?
Yes, exactly.
And
exactly.
So there's a way to handle that. And so to see people that have handled that in a huge way...
That's a talent in itself.
It's a talent. And I learned a lot. There was three people I really learned a lot from just by watching. People I really respected, musicians. And they all came together like in my life right at about the same time, which was Jimmy, Billy Gibbons, and Cat Edmondson. Those three. Just watching those people.
Yeah.
Because they were three artists they created their own worlds, their own musical worlds, and they would invite you into those worlds. I learned that from them. And they were also serious people and artists, and they just knew how to talk to everybody and make everybody feel good. And they're just wonders to watch how they navigate playing a gig, you know, doing the music, navigating, you know, the people in the audience and everybody. Those people are masters at that, you know.
Yeah.
They're masters of the game, you know, that we're in.
Totally. Hey, I have a question for you that I've been meaning to ask you since the very beginning.
Sure.
What are these songs? Like when you're playing, like you said, Jimmy said, hey, you know, so you could work up a couple songs before, so he'd know what he was getting himself into.
Oh, right.
When you're playing, are some of these standards or some of these old blues songs? Are some of these just like, hey, 1-4-5? And
well, probably all the above. You know, some are...
What's on the Dupree album?
Those are all songs. I'm trying to think. Most of them are original songs.
So you wrote them.
And Jake wrote, I think Jake wrote one or two. I wrote the rest. I think we covered All or Nothing at All. And then on the CD, because originally we were just going to make the vinyl record. There was only, we can only fit 6 songs on that thing.
Oh, okay. So then the CD, I think we did
a version of Close to You by the Carpenters.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we did a Horace Silver song, Cooking at the Continental, right?
Uh-huh.
And we were like, we got to do that. And we did another cover that was a Blue Note. The saxophone player Tina Brooks did it, called David the King, which I really like him a lot. And so we did do some covers. But organ trio stuff, like that soul jazz stuff, and the reason I like it so much is because it's so flexible. Because you can play all blues, you could play all standards if you wanted to. But my model was always the saxophone player Lou Donaldson, who had organ groups on Blue Note in the 60s. They made these classic soul jazz organ records. And his records were always the best. Alligator Boogaloo was the one that was like kind of the template for all of them in a way. But he would do like a boogaloo, then he would do a swing, then he would do like a ballad. And he would mix, and then he would do a pop song. So that was kind of the formula that I used. Like when I started playing the gallery, because I wasn't playing to jazz audience.
Right.
It was like, and even today, like you might have on a Sunday, a lot of people want to hear jazz. You might have a kind of a jazz audience. Or even within the same night, you might have a listening audience, and the next set might be just people wanting to dance, right? And that organ trio could switch like that. It could be a dance band, it could be a blues band, it could be a jazz band. And the organ melded all those things together that, in my mind, no other instrumentation can do, and made it all sound like the same thing. Like they were like...
Made it match. Yeah.
It made it match. So that's why... and I have different guitar players that I play with. You know, what I do with Jimmy is different from what I would do with Derek or Denny Freeman or Johnny Moeller, who's more funky. And then, or Jake Langley, who's a world-class jazz musician.
He is unfucking believable, man.
Yeah, and he...
I mean, he is smoking on that fucking album.
Yeah, and he just... He'll be looking at the painting on the wall and playing like that. Like, but see, he was in New York. I mean, he's got an amazing history. And he was in New York playing with, you know, the organ players. Joey DeFrancesco was in that group for 5 years. Jimmy Smith, Jimmy McGriff, Lonnie Smith. Like, he knows how to play that thing. Plus, he also played... you know, Broadway shows. He played with George Coleman, the great saxophone player, Bobby Hutcherson. I mean, he is a real checked out jazz guy. But the difference with Jake is he also loves playing that organ thing. Like, he can play that. He loves playing blues. He loves that. He understands the history of that jazz trio, organ jazz trio. So he loves all of that. Whereas, and he plays in that style. It melds with it, you know? Yeah.
I like it because the tones, sometimes stuff, one of you guys will start and it takes a second to figure out who's going.
Oh, right.
Is that guitar or is that organ?
Yeah, he was great. So when he moved to town a few years ago and walked up, you know, and I've had so many experiences in the gallery, and that was one. Jake was there and he was like, he had some of his CDs, you know, and he was like, hey, my name's Jake. And I was like, well, I know who you are, you know, because I'd seen him.
Yeah.
You know, on videos and in magazines and stuff, playing with the organ players. I was like, well, what are you doing here? You know, he's like, oh, I moved here. And it was like, great. So once he got there, you know, I mean, that guy, he can play any standard. I mean, it was good for me when Jake moved here because it made me, I had to play some things that I didn't know how to play, you know? And I do that all the time. I'm constantly learning, which is, you know, the best part about playing music.
Yeah.
It never gets old.
Yeah.
Like,
especially
it never
taking on an instrument midway, you know what I mean? Or whatever way, you're quarter of a way through, whatever the hell you're through.
No, that's true.
You know?
And before that, I was playing steel guitar, like flat steel, not pedal steel.
Right.
Straight flat steel. And then at a certain point, I decided I was going to put it through. I started playing organ songs. I would put it through a flanger or something to make it sound like a Leslie. And I would do big John Patton songs. I would do organ songs.
Yeah.
And then I think that was the step before I realized, well, I'm on the stage at Antone's doing this, trying to make it sound like an organ. And there's an organ right here. Why don't I just go play that?
Hey, let me ask you a question. Do you know guys that come to your house and fix an organ such as this one?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You got to get me a number before you go.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few guys in town. I mean, I've been going to a guy, he went to Hammond Organ School. He was, you know, Doug Clark. He's an older guy now.
Will that's he the understand guy kinda, the Baldwin Overture fun time machine?
He might. Bob Overton's also real good. And there's also a guy, Stan Jones. Those three guys, I think, you know, any of them would be great.
Yeah. Hey, congratulations on the Dupree album.
Thanks.
Getting in Jay Trachtenberg's top 10. Wow. Of just all albums, not even just Austin albums. All albums.
All albums. That I couldn't believe that when I saw that.
Well, you know what? I can, you know, and I recommend it. I was having some, it's the saddest thing. I just spent a lot of time with my family, you know, over Christmas. We sit around my grandma's table in the morning and talk. So like at 7:30 in the morning, my uncle and my cousins and I were all talking online.
Right.
And I was listening to your stuff. I just kept on like you guys got to go check this out right now. And like they did, my uncle, who likes jazz, but isn't like a music guy, totally blown away.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
He was like, this is fucking great.
Well,
yeah, it's a great,
that.
Great album, man.
Well, thanks. You know, that just happened to be one of those days in the studio where it seemed like an easy day in the studio. And we didn't plan. We didn't know what songs we were going to play. We didn't have... We had a band. We played Sunday night, but... And we had a lot of those songs. Those were the first time that we played it. Matter of fact, The Turtle, the first song, that kind of funky one,
yeah.
That we had never played. I dreamed that little melody the night before, and I had sang it into my recorder when I woke up in the middle of the night. Kind of forgotten about it. Went in, and then I thought, oh, what was that? And thought, well, let's do this, and we'll go the four for the bridge or something, and let's just go do it. And so we just went in. We had not rehearsed it. We just talked it through. And we had never played it. And that what you hear on that album, that's what it was, our first yeah. time we ever played that.
Well, the coolest thing, too, is like you're doing this kind of music that holds in a certain tradition and is meant to be recorded in a certain way. And that's how you did it, live to two, track to tape.
Yeah.
That's how you do those albums.
Yeah, that's how those guys did them. And
that's how you do it. You just play.
So great. You just play, yeah.
And it's supposed to be a fun time in the afternoon, and not necessarily throwaway, but it's not sweated over like a fucking like Guns N' Roses Chinese Democracy. You know what I mean? Where
right.
it takes 25 years to get an album out because you're fretting over the chorus of a song.
Yeah,
you're playing music. You do it.
Yeah, this is what we do all the time.
This is what we do all the time.
Yeah, and there was no pressure on that record because we didn't really go in to make it. It kind of came, like I said, through. I was making the other record, so we were like, well, let's just do this. And so if it didn't turn out... See, this is kind of my other thing about recording, like just recording in general, if I'm doing something on my own. It's like, I'm going to record, and maybe it's not going to be good. And so I just won't do it, or I won't put it out, or I'll do it again. Like, I don't put that pressure on myself. Okay, well, I've spent this money, and I'm in the studio,
right.
and I've got to get it.
Right.
And if I don't like it, then I'm just not going to... put it out, or I don't feel bad, like
right.
I'm just like, well, I'm just not. But luckily that day it came out, I was like, oh, well, let's put this out, this seems like it's good, you know.
Yeah,
this will be great.
That's awesome.
So yeah, I really
like the way
that.
it should be easy, and it has a vibe. Like the whole album has a vibe that is a good vibe. Like it has a character.
Yeah, we just ran it down. Hey, what song do you want to do? Let's do this. And those songs were just, we just played them once for the most part,
yeah.
maybe twice. I mean, maybe, but usually not.
And so you said you're also working on a Mike Flanagan Trio album?
No, this
no,
is like
is
a
that?
Solo record. What happened was...
Mike Flanagan.
I had like a few years ago, you know, I just like my whole life like just fell apart, you know. And
best albums.
Right. And so I thought but and as I went through that period, you know, for a couple of years, I thought, God, this is the best story. Like the best stories out of this time period, you know. Mm. Such a great this would be a great movie, you know, or a great book or something. But I thought, well, I'm a musician. Like I can't write a book. I can't make a movie. I'll make an album. Like, and I actually didn't start out. I just would write a song about something, and then I would go, oh, I'll write this song. I didn't sing any of them. I was like, well, I'll get, you know, Kat to sing this beautiful jazz song, you know, like, or I'll get, you know, I wrote this kind of, you know, soul song, you know, like. Really cool. So I'll get Gary Clark. He'll sing that. You know, Billy Gibbons will sing this other song. You know, Alejandro is going to sing this song. You know, like, so I just did that. So it just tells a story, but.
You really had all those people sing on your thing?
Yeah. So that's the album Nobody Knows that I've been working on.
You're literally the coolest guy. Like, you have a record with Billy Gibbons, Alejandro, and Cat Edmondson?
Yeah.
And Gary Clark.
And Gary and Reverend Gene West from The Relatives does this. Soliloquy kind of thing. It's really cool, and
that's wicked, man.
It's and it tells a story. You know, it's the story of my life falling apart, right? Because I think that was at the
it's
time.
Not, it's the only artist that revel in that sort of thing. But say, this is my life falling apart. Like, you're
well,
saying, like,
it was.
Most people would be like, "Oh, that was the time of my life
right.
falling apart." You know,
well,
I mean?
I think at that point
to learn from it, that's our journey too. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that was right at the time when I realized, like. And I had met Kat, and Kat kind of had said, You know, before I just thought, well, I'm just a guy playing a club, you know. I sell beer, basically, you know. And I think, you know, and this, maybe I started playing with Jimmy or Billy would come, you know, like some little things, you know, would start happening. And I remember Kat thinking, well, you're more than that, you know. She said that, you know. She's like, oh, yeah, you know, you can do more. Like, yeah, you're more than that guy.
Yeah.
And so when everything started falling apart, I thought, well, if you're going to be an artist, like, your job is to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. Like, you spill your guts out. You know, I always say, like, when you...
Once again, the most important job.
Play a gig is to leave some blood on the stage.
Yeah.
That's what people want, because they're going through their lives and they want to hear... They want to identify with something that's real. You know, that's absolutely real. Like...
Yeah.
Not just some showbiz thing, or I don't write, and I never considered myself a songwriter, although I had written songs, but then I wrote all these songs and they turned out so good with these people, and I thought, oh, well, I guess I can write songs. Like, I'd really been doing it since I was a kid, and I write instrumentals, like, obviously for organ stuff, but I really wrote these songs, you know, and they were all were about something. They told a story. They were factual songs, you know, like, if you listen to that record, you know, you would understand the story. So,
so what happened? You split with your wife?
I split up with my wife. So I was going through that. And it was, you know, some of the worst times in my life. And it was some of the greatest times in my life. It was everything.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Those are the most inspiring.
And so it was everything all at once. It wasn't just like, oh, this is a sad story. This guy's depressed. It right. wasn't that, you know. It was just everything all happening at once. And there was so much of it. I just thought, I've got to record this now. I can't record it later because I'll look back at it and it won't be the same.
Yeah, it won't look the same.
I've got to record this stuff now. So I would record as I went along, you know, and I would get it. And it captured, you know, when I listened back to it. You know, it's hard to listen. It's hard for me to listen to that album. It's getting mastered right now. And so it was, you know, I had to work on it. And it was hard to listen to because it would bring me right back to those times, you know. And
that's amazing, though, because it's so raw and there's no perspective. Like, you wrote it from being in it, as right. opposed to with hindsight
yes.
and some kind of
yes.
idea and resolution. You wrote it from the kind of the frantic
the
point
time,
of in the moment.
When it was happening.
Yeah.
Exactly.
With no perspective, where it's raw.
Where
yeah.
it was raw.
Yeah.
And so, and there, I mean, there's, I don't even play on some of the songs. Like the Alejandro song.
That's cool as shit, though. That sounds like Brian Wilson.
It was funny because, like, the Alejandro song, I thought, I want my, like, this song's like a, you know, kind of a punk, you know, but glam punk tune. Who's my dream team for that? Like, Alejandro, obviously, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I wanted Clem Burke on drums from Blondie,
God
right?
God damn you.
So I was like, and then I was like, who's my ultimate, like, you know, I was like, well, I got to get Dominique Davalos to play bass and, you know, sing part of it. You know, that's my dream team, like Dominique and Clem and Alejandro. Like, that, those are the guys I want to see play this. And so, yeah, that's what I got, you know, and one take, you know, bam. It's just so killer.
You're literally the coolest guy ever. That
but
is amazing.
What was funny is, so I sang it, you know, they played it.
Yeah.
And then Alejandro sang it, and then I thought, well, I'll put organ on it. Well, when I put organ on, I thought, now this sounds, doesn't sound right.
Yeah.
So I just took the organ off. And then, like, on the Cat song, like, I had, you know, Stephen Barber,
of
the
course.
Arranger?
Yeah,
so,
he's been on the show.
So I didn't play on that song, like, it was like a jazz song, and then I had this big orchestration, you know, that Barber did, you know, with all these strings, you know. And I had a prelude to that. And so, like, I was like, well, I can't play on that. I don't want to play on this. Like, that's, so I had to realize, like, is this weird that I'm not playing on some of my solo record?
No.
But then I thought,
you're the composer and, like, the...
Right. Like, yeah. I'm telling a story.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not just
yeah.
throwing... I'm not going to throw something on just yeah. to say, oh,
because,
well, yeah.
Because I'm not on... Yeah. But
yeah,
you are. You
didn't
are.
Make any
it's
sense.
You.
Yeah,
it's
it was
you,
my story.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
it was...
Yeah, yeah.
These people were my voice, you
yeah.
know? And, Like the solo section in the Cat song, like, you know, I did the melody. Well, this is the melody that I want, and then Barber arranged it. So I felt like I was playing something that I couldn't play on the organ. I needed a whole orchestra to say what I wanted to say musically. You know, I couldn't do it on the organ. Like, So I needed, you know,
yeah,
I had the idea, the musical idea, and I just had Barbara be the organ in a way, you know, just make this thing. So, and then I did play guitar on that a little bit. Me and Kat did another song. It was just me and her. I played guitar and she sang. And then there's one thing where I just play guitar, acoustic guitar. It's a track. So
that's awesome, man.
So it's, you know, I'm excited about that record.
When do you think it's going to come out? If it's off to master right now, what's the...
You know, I don't know, because I'm going to have, I'm going to try and take it around and, you know, about trying to get a real label. But, you know, this is just, I've just done it on my own.
What? Let me ask you this. Who did someone put out the Dupree?
Yeah, that was Jim Eno.
He did it himself? That's his
he
label?
He started a label. He did? And now he's put out another record, too, recently. He just wanted to do vinyl. And he just liked, he loved that record, you know, he just loved doing it. And so he was like, I'll start a label, you know, and put this out.
What
know?
A cool guy.
He's so cool.
Jim Eno is so cool.
The best. Yeah. I love Jim.
And one of my favorite drummers.
Oh, yeah. And he's like.
Of all time.
He's so killer.
Yeah. I mean, like song drummers, like.
He's amazing.
Plays the drums on songs like. Yeah. And
I love
shit he comes up with
guys.
Is. Yeah.
These people, man. I mean, they're so. Unique, you know, and they're so good, and they're so different, right?
Yeah.
Everybody's so different. Like, I'm in a constant awe of who I get to meet.
Yeah,
and not just musicians too, just people. I mean, I just like.
Who did anyone cool come out and jam on the Gibbons' birthday this last week in New
York? Well, you know, my big
oh, you
thing
were playing with
that.
Anton Figg and
yeah, Anton
and fucking
Figg
Will Lee.
And Will Lee from the Letterman Band. That was the rhythm section, right? And so, of course, I'd never met those guys or played with them. And so, that one of the, you know, so I was, I don't really get nervous anymore, but because I think, hey, you know,
I'm here for a reason.
I mean, I can yeah. play. Like, yeah, there's one thing I know. Like, okay, I know I can play, right? So, whether somebody likes it or not, that's another thing. And also, my approach to playing is, I realize to be able to play something that seems, like, really beyond your limits, your capabilities, like, to really go for it and have that really magical minute there, right, like, during a, when you're playing, is that you have to be willing to make mistakes. And so, I factor that in. And I'm not afraid to hit clunkers, and sometimes that's all you'll hit, you know. You have to be willing to do that.
Those guys know that.
Yeah. So, but you know, sometimes when you do play, and I realize, like, that's my mindset, and you could have a different mindset, and you could play everything you know, and it would be really good, you know. And I'm not saying I don't play like that sometimes, but my goal is... not worry about notes, really. And so, but sometimes when you play with guys like that, you're like, oh man, is it going to be one of those nights that I just start clunking or something? Maybe it will be. Yeah. I don't know. So I'm always a little nervous that might happen. But they were great. And
but there wasn't like any Steve Vai kind of guys didn't come out?
No, Greg Allman came out, which
was
pretty
cool. Oh, yeah, I saw a
cool.
picture of that. That's
that
pretty
was pretty cool. He came back and he was really complimentary and nice.
You guys talk organ stuff?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, we talked organ stuff. And there was a lot of organ players at that gig, man. Like, guys I didn't know, but people that played with, you know, people. And
how's Gibbons to work with, like, even, like, just on a rehearsal thing? Is it fun? Well, just fun?
Well, it was fun because, like, even that, we never rehearsed for it, you know? Like, we just sound checked, and then we're like, what's going to be the end or whatever? But those guys, I mean, those Letterman guys, you know, they played with each other. It's just like a machine, you know? They're there, you know? You just have to put some frosting on it. But it was funny. Like, Will Lee came in, and there was some song we were doing, and he had some sheet music for it, you know? He gave it to me, and But, you know, I can't read, you know, which always is funny because obviously a lot of people can't read in musicians.
Right.
But you always think the keyboard player can read because that's the guy
that's usually the guy.
Was taking piano lessons when he was five, you know.
Right.
That guy can always read. Yeah. No one else can read. And so I always feel weird, like, well, I can't read. But that's not how I came up, you know. So, but anyway, he was really cool about it. He was like, oh, no, don't worry about it. I said, just tell me what it is. And he did. And then later on, I told him the story of how I started to play, you know. And so those guys, you know, they loved it. I mean, and they were
so
super,
cool.
Super nice. And, really.
Let me ask you this. Here's a question that I've been wanting to ask for a while, because I wanted to ask Van when he was on here too, is what songs did you guys play when you played with ZZ Top at Montreux?
Yeah, we played, I'm trying to think, we did this song Kiko, which is a Jimmy McGriff kind of little instrumental thing. And then that has since morphed into, because we did this Daryl Hall TV show.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Tell me, that, oh God.
That has since, Kiko is, it was an instrumental. And then Gibbons added words, let's have a party, right? So that turned into let's have a party. But at the ZZ Top show, we did Kiko. And then he gave me, because we were doing this, the reason that I was there, you know, was because they were doing this tribute to Claude Knobs, the founder.
Right.
And so they wanted to do something jazzy, special. In there.
Right.
And so we did Kiko, and then we did, then they gave me just, I played solo organ, ballad, jazz ballad, you know, it was just like, that was weird too. It was like spotlight on me in the middle of the ZZ Top show. And then it was just me for a few minutes, you know, just playing jazz ballad, you know, and then we segued into, Dusty singing I Loved a Woman, that Freddie King tune, Slow Blues. So that's what we did.
I like Dusty singing too.
Oh, I love Dusty. I had never met him. Of course I had met Billy, but I'd never met
The only one of those guys I've ever met was Billy.
Yeah. And that was so, and I knew, but Billy had even mentioned, he goes, oh man, you know, because that was ZZ Top. That was, they all had to approve that. There was not like a
flippant decision, yeah.
Right? So that was something that really had to be discussed. And so, but I had not met those guys. So when I did meet them, you know, Billy made sure, hey man, when you come out for the show, you know, this isn't just me, this is ZZ Top, you know, you know, so make sure, and he didn't have to, because I couldn't wait to meet Dusty and Frank anyway, but, but you know, but me and Dusty hit it off, and me and Frank, you know, Frank's pretty quiet, but, you know, we're all Texas guys, they love that, and we're from Dallas, and so, and I spent more time with Dusty on that trip than Billy, because Billy had his wife there, and me and Dusty just hung out the whole time. And it was a blast. I loved hanging out with Dusty.
That's so cool.
He was really cool. And, yeah, that was another.
When does that, how Daryl's, Live at Daryl's House?
Oh, that's going to air in February, very beginning of February. Gibbons sent me an email the other day and told, I forget the date.
Did you have fun? Is he a nice guy?
He was very nice.
Daryl?
Oh, he was super nice, too. Like, and I didn't know what to expect. You never know, you know.
You didn't ever watch that show?
Yeah, I had watched that show, but I thought, well, I wonder what kind of guy he'll be. Like, I don't know.
He seems like
he could go either way. If you don't know. Like, I don't know.
To me, he seems like that. Once I saw that show, then I was like, okay then he's not. He's. I don't think he could go the other way.
Right.
Because why would you have that show if you weren't like a guy? It'd be like me just being a total asshole when I was out meeting people. Right. You know what I mean? Right. Obviously, I have this show, so I like hanging out with people and talking to them.
I guess I just know so few celebrity people that I guess as a normal, you're going, well, I don't know, you know?
Well, right.
How would it be?
Right. But he seems like a guy that wants to connect with.
Well, right. No,
with his peers.
Yeah, that's true. And he was he was super nice, man. As nice as could. Everybody on that show.
God, all the musicians, such a dream of mine, producer, is to sit in a room with him and
oh, he was great. Say stuff. Well, you know, then we had, you know, we played, and then at the end, you sit down and have dinner, and they film the whole thing. I think it's a few seconds in the show, but in reality, you're there for an hour or an hour and a half eating dinner, right? And so it just happened to be like me, Billy Gibbons, and Daryl Hall were right together, right? And no one else seemed to be talking. It was just, and I was asking them all about the Philly Soul Jet, you know,
all the Gamble and Huff, and once
I brought that up, you know, he was just, he loved it. And, you know, he was going, man, I used to play just piano on those sessions, you know, before Hall, you know, Gamble and Huff stuff. He was telling me all about it, and so we had some, I was really interested in that, because that's some of my favorite music ever, is that Philly Soul stuff, and, but he was just super great, you know, super nice, and then at the end he goes, Billy had brought some, was it some tequila, I think, that he, you know, like, for everyone there,
right,
boxes of tequila that he makes or endorses, I'm not quite sure what, but Billy wasn't drinking, you know, so. But Daryl was like, oh, yeah, well, let's try some of this out, you know. And he pours a shot, and he's like, yeah, yeah, Flanagan, you want a shot? I was like, yeah, man, I guess, right? Like, I don't really drink shots of tequila too much, right. But I was like, yeah, I'm going to have them with Daryl Hall. Hall.
Yeah.
I'm going to have a shot of tequila with you. And so we did, man. He was just fun, man. Yeah. He was just a regular guy. And, you know, that's a guy, just a musician, you know?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah.
Just and he could sit down and play the heck out of the piano. He played guitar the whole time when we did the gig. And he sounded great. Matter of fact, when we were we would go over a song maybe for a minute, pass around some solos. There was guitar players there besides Gibson and stuff. But then, like, when we would be going over it, Daryl Hall might take a solo, right, on the guitar, which I always thought was super cool because he was...
He's really good.
Simple and just... not. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
It wasn't all guitar player-y.
Yeah, but it has flavor.
Right?
Yeah.
And then we'd go to cut it or whatever, tape it, and he would... They would go, okay, well, we're going to do... Here's the order of the solos. And they would leave them out, you know? I was like, well... Hey man, what happened to yours? And he was like, oh, no way, you know, I can't play solo. But he could, you know, and he was good at it, you know. But he wouldn't do it on the thing.
How cool, man. Well, people should check that out, and you should get the Dupree album, which is available also for those of you who have 8-track.
Yes, get the 8-track.
And hey, will you have albums there tonight at the vinyl?
Dupree Records? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I meant to ask you that. When I saw it was on vinyl, I was like, shit, I've listened to that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the vinyl sounds really good on that, man.
Yeah, I bet.
Because, see, we went straight from 2-track tape, which we recorded on, straight slate. Master. And there's one, a lot of people don't think it's true, but there is a little digital step, like, on the mastering lathe of a lot of machines. But we got some older machine, did not have that, right? So it was just all straight.
Wow.
No, nothing. You know, it was just straight analog. And so on that record, man, you put it on and you just really hear the room. And
yeah.
It is a lot different.
Looking forward
record.
To it.
So anyway, yeah, for sure. I'll get you.
And your solo album, you'll have some news. People can go to MikeFlanagan.com.
Yeah. Yeah, I've kind of kept that under wraps. I haven't told anybody about it. So this may be the first hint.
That's an exciting album. And I wish you a lot of luck on that.
Oh, well, thanks.
Is there anything else that I'm missing?
Gosh, that seems like a lot.
This has been a great conversation.
Well,
I've always wanted to talk to you. And
well,
now,
thanks for having me, man. Because I think that's one of the greatest questions we all ask ourselves is how did we get here, man?
I bet you've been asking yourself that a lot this year.
I ask myself that all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the answer is, but I like the question, and it's a great question. And I love the show. I love hearing what other people's answers are to that.
Yeah. It's so funny because when I thought of the name... It was more of like a cry of...
a cry of help.
How did I get here? but still, yeah, it can be anyway. Well, thank you so much, and I'm really looking forward to it. Who's playing tonight with you? Frosty?
Frosty, and then I think it may just be me and Frosty the first set, and then I think Derek's going to play the second set.
Okay. So. Well, I'll be there. I'll see you there.
It'd be good to see you.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Mike Flanagan. Amazing. I went last week. I went that night, the night after this, or the night that we did this interview. And it was incredible. He did one set, just him and Frosty, just the two guys, totally rich, full sound, great jams, great grooves, great show. If you are listening to this the day that it comes out, Friday, January 3rd, or Saturday, January 4th, he is playing both of those nights in Austin, Texas at the Continental Club Gallery upstairs. Go up there, check it out. It's amazing. The other thing, too, is all the cool, you know, musicians in town were there. That's for sure. Everyone who wasn't playing was off, and people that were getting done with their gigs were coming up to see him. What a great show. All right? You can find him at MikeFlanagan.com. Find out if he's coming to a town near you. He's had a great year. I wish him a great 2014. I also wish you guys, the listeners, a beautiful 2014. Thank you so much for listening to the show, making my 2013 so good. It's because of you guys, really. And the guests that come on this show that make me happy. Seriously. I wish you all a great 2014. And let's have some more Dupree. And you should get this album. Go to MikeFlanagan.com. Find this thing. This guy's amazing. Get into his trip and check out some more Dupree. All right? Happy New Year, guys. Let's get down.